Hey there, if you would like ad-free and early versions of these episodes, as well as bonus episodes, movie club episodes, and lots more, head on over to patreon.com/Craig and Friends.
It's whimsically volatile.
Here we are again, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemans, here we are.
We're ready to do a delightful show for you and enjoy it ourselves.
That's exactly right. It's all in the service of enjoyment, knowledge, and togetherness.
How's your week been?
Well, it's been a roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
But so I wonder, Craig, if you can indulge me.
I suppose so.
Can you indulge me in an episode of The Realness?
I think that could be arranged.
Now, you have to. Okay. So for the listeners at home, I would like to refrain from joking.
Okay.
I'd like to refrain from hyperbole.
Sure.
I'd like to also refrain from frothy emotional appeals.
Okay.
And I want to engage in a measured, calm discussion of what I perceive to be and have been the facts.
That sounds perfectly acceptable. However, okay, if we do lapse into some of the shenanigans, yeah, we won't punish ourselves too
no,
much.
No, because this is not, right, we're not, it, this is not the 12, or what is it? This is not the Stations of the Cross.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Right. That's tomorrow that we're doing that.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I believe it's some kind of Pentecostal. I think it's Pentecost, something like that in the Christian calendar. But for all intents and purposes, it's just another day of the week right now.
Sure. Some penne pasta.
Yeah. But so if the listeners recall, we had my OG yoga master, Kate O'Donnell, on, and she talked about energetic qualities of the mind and body.
Yeah.
And she mentioned the sattvic quality. And this is a way of describing the body, mind, and spirit as it is naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, natural, of course, is an elusive term, because what the hell does that even mean anymore?
Sure, right. It's like normal.
Right. For it's just all things being equal, with no major antagonizing forces, with no major traumas, with no major trials and tribulations. It's just normal. Mm-hmm. Right. And one thing that I've struggled to do my whole life is to speak in a measured, normal, sincere voice and tone.
Mm-hmm.
And from my trials and tribulations as of late, I realized the cause of that is a layer of shame. A shame of my voice sounding faggoty, or my voice appearing not as masculine as it should be.
Uh-huh.
So that is due to a fear of not being accepted, not being loved, not being welcomed, mm-hmm, into society.
Sure.
You know, and that's something I think most people can relate to.
Yeah. There's some aspect of everyone's personality that they feel like they're trying to keep a damper on.
Exactly. They're trying to locate their chill.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to report to the listeners at home that I have located my chill.
Fantastic. Yeah.
It feels great.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it feels pretty chill. You know, we're in Hollywood, which means that we're narcissistic.
Well, it's West Hollywood, so... Oh,
so super narcissistic.
Yeah, but there you go. Right, right. I didn't want you to downplay it.
Yeah. Again, we're trying to avoid hyperbole and frothy emotional appeals.
Mm-hmm.
But in the service of honesty and open and direct lines of communication, I have located my chill.
When did you realize that you've located your chill?
This morning.
As good a time as any.
Yeah.
So you woke up and you felt what?
Chill.
Just kind of a calm, even, serene.
Yeah. Clean, serene, mm-hmm, and not nasty nor mean.
A state we all want to arrive at in the morning.
Yeah. You know, this is an elusive quality for many and most people. But one thing that I've found through all of my searching and all of my pain and all of my spectacular successes and failures is that it is our weaknesses that bind us together and not our strengths.
Explore that a little.
Well, I think that I had a nervous breakdown and I had an identity crisis,
mm-hmm,
and pretty recently.
Yeah.
And it was public, you know, but the thing about me, so I'm trying to, you know, I always try to avoid cliches and maudlin kind of bumper sticker phrases.
Sure.
Like, I'm just trying to find myself, or, you know, like a return to me.
Right.
Just because that's not my style.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's a personal preference.
They make you cringe a bit, those.
It's a little bit cringy. I make an effort to reject those phrases and bumper stickers and cliches because I suffer from a disease that is a pattern of thinking described as terminally unique.
Okay. That is?
That is the insistent and stubborn refusal to admit that you're just like everybody else.
Sure. Right.
And that's the truth.
Right. Because a lot of times people think that their particular woes are so unique to them that either they can't share them or there's no solution to them.
Right. Or the opposite, that my particular woes are so dazzling and giant in scope that I could make $50 million off these. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And it has all been, it's been a lifelong process leading up to this moment. And my, I have a compelling and kind of unavoidable urge to share them because I realize that one facet of my life's purpose, the thing that I've always wanted to do, is talk to people.
Right.
RuPaul describes herself many times as an introvert masquerading as an extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I'm actually the opposite.
Oh, really?
I'm an extrovert masquerading as an introvert.
So how does that present?
Well, I love people.
Sure.
I'm fascinated by people. I love talking to them, seeing what makes them tick, observing their actions and their patterns, and noticing what I perceive motivates their desires. Mm-hmm. Trying to get to the bottom of stuff.
Yeah.
This, sometimes this involves me just observing them and not reacting, or and sometimes it involves me engaging them for long, long periods of time through discourse and through like therapeutic discussions, whether that can be, you know, sometimes light, sometimes heavy.
Sure.
You know, I've gone to certain recovery programs since I was, since 2005. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned and gained from my experience in those programs and doing the work that's involved in those programs is levels and layers of spiritual transformation that is absolutely not a joke. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that I've felt to be real and worth pursuing. Hmm. I've learned that if I maintain a strict but not ruthless adherence to spiritual principles, anything that happens in my life will just turn out just fine.
Okay. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it reorients the priority list to,
sticking to your values,
sticking to my values. And then anything that I do, whether that's the dishes or a large scale piece of artwork or a world tour for, lip sync gymnastic wiggling.
Yeah.
It all just comes out in the wash and everything turns out just A-okay.
Right. Because you're going from that place.
Exactly. You're moving from a moral, spiritual, and ethical code.
Yeah.
That was constructed and built and nurtured by people who've come before me and all in the service of God, or if you like, good orderly direction.
Yeah.
And, so I've returned to that format, thank God, after a extraordinarily violent and painful physical and metaphysical reckoning with all of my patterns of behavior.
And how long was that time in the wilderness, if you will?
It was a while. Mm-hmm. It was all, after Drag Race, when I started doing, hardcore drugs again, I hopped back on the crazy train.
Sure. Because it's hard to operate from a place of centered integrity when you're blowing your mind up.
Yeah. It's impossible. Yeah. That is the cold, hard fact.
Yeah.
That it is impossible to behave with integrity, honesty, and compassion when I because I really don't wish to impose my values on other people because I don't know that that works.
Right.
But when I stop shoveling hardcore narcotics into my gaping maw, I realize that everything levels out to a place that is just indescribably serene.
We've discussed before about how RuPaul asked you, have you ever considered that you might be addicted to anxiety? Do you think that the pursuit of that sort of fucked up state, a way for you to avoid and crush that serenity?
Absolutely. When I talk about Ru, my pattern or my knee-jerk reaction is to say, she's not a guru, she's not a psychotherapist, but I actually like to give credit where it's due.
Sure.
Because I have learned so much about life from teachers who are either unintentional mentors or just strangers on the street.
Sure.
And what I've learned from her, and sorry, what I've learned from him, because I'm not talking about RuPaul the Glamazon.
Right.
I'm talking about RuPaul Andre Charles, the man who's written many books and who talks on the on his great podcast and shares generously lots and lots of wisdom from his hard-earned life experience.
Yeah.
The gratitude that I have for him is extraordinary because he was generous enough to see in me, I think, what he has also experienced in his life. I'm an extremist.
Sure.
I mean,
you may be familiar with Brian's work and the tendencies to be a touch extreme.
I mean, we talked about, we were on the way here, Craig and I were talking about, I'm coming in hot.
That's right. You better be ready because I'm coming in hot.
Yeah. And when I do things, I go full tilt hog ham.
Yeah.
And that sometimes works out to my benefit and to the entertainment and inspiration of others. Other times that works very much to my detriment into the pain and shrapnel taking of my people in the surrounding radius.
Right. An example of which would be, say, the drug use or...
The drug use.
Yeah.
The wild, unhinged, neurotic, psychotic, and sociopathic behavior patterns. Paranoia.
That's a big one.
Delusions of grandeur.
That can eat up a lot of time too.
It's very time consuming.
Yeah.
It's extremely time consuming.
Draining too, just the paranoia, just the neuroses.
The neuroses. It, the neurochemistry that is happening there literally gives me a headache.
Yeah.
I feel like if you've ever had a stressful day and sometimes you feel that your brain is trying to burst out of your skull, that's because the synapses and the neurons are firing in so many directions. And of course, I'm not a fucking neuroscientist.
Well, it's okay though. You don't have to be, you know, certified to discuss the topic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's this, this very relatable feeling of you're running around in circles. It's a, you're doing a marathon in your brain. You're going back, you're going forward. You're trying anywhere but here.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, I've always been a seeker of relief.
Sure.
And I've sought every conceivable angle, whether that's physical, substance, induced, metaphysical.
Yeah.
I'm 35 and I got to tell you, I've covered every fucking base except stillness.
Well, that's the scariest one, right?
It's not for me, it's not scary. And it's just unfamiliar.
Yeah.
It's unfamiliar territory. When you are able to, or no, when you're willing to sit quietly and observe the patterns of thinking in your brain,
right,
you become well acquainted with what RuPaul calls your inner saboteur.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The monkey mind.
Yeah.
Because we're primates.
Sure.
And... we react to power. We covet things. We, all of the seven deadly sins are always those instinctual urges are swirling and undulating and, really cramping our inner peace style.
Yeah.
And so we reach for stuff and I've reached for everything. I've reached for sex. I've reached for every single drug besides heroin. Thank God. I've done oxys, but I've reached for every drug. I've reached for every behavior.
Yeah.
I've sought and chased fear to its absolute logical conclusion. And, you know, in certain programs of recovery, they talk about the last houses on the left are jails, institutions, and death.
Right.
Well, I got arrested by about seven cops, naked,
yeah,
handcuffed, screaming into their faces.
Again, an extreme.
Extreme. I was institutionalized voluntarily, but nevertheless, I was institutionalized because that was the last thing it was the last house on the left because I did what I never thought I would ever do, which was scare the ever loving fuck out of my mother and disappoint my dad.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I enjoy a luxury that many, many people are not ever able to enjoy, which is the unconditional love of my family unit.
Sure.
And that's
a wonderful thing that you have that.
It's a huge gift that I've never taken for granted. But then the other last house was death.
Yeah.
I truly believed, and you know, we talk about reality, talk about not reality. We can talk about layers of self and perception until we're blue in the face. But I truly, truly believed in a psychotic, delusional episode that I had died. Mm-hmm. And that I felt and experienced on every level of being and perception that the world was ending and that death was here and it was just black.
And well, if you're going to think of a theme park ride that's going to approximate right. death, yeah. that sounds about as close as you can get to it.
But in looking back though, is like during this period of when I had to, when I went to rehab, I had no internet. I had no phone. I was just in a house with, 9 other men.
Yeah.
And we were, we had to cooperate with one another to mm-hmm. eat meals, to cook and prepare meals, to create boundaries, to discuss our feelings, to discuss what were our strategies for recovery and re-entry into society. Where did we come from? Where are we going? Yada, yada, yada. And it occurred to me then that I was chasing fear like fucking Lance Armstrong. Uh-huh. And nothing. And I just looked for the scariest shit ever. I didn't look fear in the face with courage. I fucking barreled into it like a bull.
How so? Give us an example of that.
Well, so stage fright. Mm-hmm. So every performer has stage fright. Everybody does.
Yeah, sure.
Everybody does. So what I would do is I would just jam a bunch of meth into my mouth to get me so jacked up that I would just barrel out on stage in a wildly unhinged, ecstatic display of just ruthless, not giving a fuck. Mm-hmm. And it was this energy. Now I'm naturally very high wired.
Right.
But I used this coping mechanism that was unsustainable in order to support my ruthless desire to be loved in public.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and every performer has that. We all are obsessed with show and tell.
Sure.
We want to tell a story. We want to show our talent.
Yeah.
So we barrel out on that stage and say, here I am. This is what I've got. Take it or leave it. I hope you love it. But you know, yada, yada, yada. And then I confronted my fear of homophobia, of not being accepted, by psychotically reacting to a figment of my imagination mm-hmm. in rehab, where I threatened some guy with a couple of golf clubs because I thought he was going to come for me, as it were.
This is when you thought the guy had called
said
you a fag.
I said, did anybody say, you know, and it turns out nobody said it, you know, and this is all the monkey mind inventing problems, because the mind is so at a dis-ease when there's no cause for alarm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of like self-sabotaging mechanism will just create it.
It'll create it because it's so used to having something like that, or it's familiar with it. And it also is a way to keep you from enjoying.
Right. And that's what Devin talked about the other day, was about this familiar pain.
Yes.
And that is one of the mechanisms of relapse when when people who are seeking relief from a drug addiction, alcoholism, sex addiction, any kind of compulsive behaviors, when you lapse back into those behaviors, it's this mechanism. It's like, I give up because I don't want to be uncomfortable. Yeah. I want to go back to this ex-lover who beats me because I know what's going to happen. I'm going to destroy myself.
Sure.
You know,
it's more appetizing than the unknown.
Right. It's the appetite for destruction.
Yeah.
You know? And I've had a huge appetite for destruction. Although I realize now that, my personality type is something that, I've always had a ruthless quest for knowledge.
Yeah.
And I have a morbid sense of humor mm-hmm. and an interest in all things grotesque and, unsettling.
Yeah.
But I've had that since I was 3.
Sure.
You know, and that's just never going to change. And I've had to reckon with this, with the drag character, because since I was very, very young, I felt like a girl.
Uh-huh.
And I felt a huge disconnection to my physical body. Mm-hmm. And I've studied a lot about, the state of being transgendered and, you know, I remember when I read Kate Bornstein's book, Gender Outlaw, I think it was called, mm-hmm. something like that. And, my idea of drag has evolved to a more serious place mm-hmm. where I look at it as the veneration of the sacred female archetype.
Okay.
For me, drag is fierce and fun. Like Alaska used to say, you know, drag is fierce and fun. It was like a mantra when we didn't want to put on drag. We'd say it in the mirror, drag is fierce and fun.
Remember?
Drag, yeah. Remember, this is all for a laugh. But for me, it was an ecstatic display of almost religious
worship.
Yeah, like the worship of the feminine ideal.
Right.
Like the goddess, you know?
The ultimate, the extra version. Yes,
the absolute, the diva.
Right.
And this makes sense because when I was in art school, I used to incorporate elements of cross-dressing and imagery of sex changes, sometimes very explicit. I remember I was telling Alaska once, I did a... when I was in the studio for Interrelated Media in Boston, I studied performance art and video work. And I did this performance where I dressed up like, with like a prom dress on and pretty like pretty bad drag. Of course, by today's standards, it was just, I mean, it was just wretched, but, I wore like an 80s kind of prom dress and I gave a slideshow of post-op vaginas to the tune of Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody.
That's quite a souffle.
It is quite a souffle. And you know, I was struggling expressing an inner kind of turmoil very shamelessly and very openly in these performances that said, and I remember I read a poem once in my sound performance class in the gist of it was, if I were a woman, a man would fuck me. He would fuck me and then stay.
Okay.
Oof.
Yeah. Because you're not.
Because
you're not a woman, so therefore those things won't happen is the underpinning of that.
Right. Because it's coming from this inherent shame of the body, which I now know for me personally is more related to the concept of original sin.
How so?
Well, we're born, I would say now we're in certain religious traditions, the body is born imperfect.
Okay.
And the life course is a series of tasks and trials in order to achieve spiritual perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading about Saint John of Climacus, I believe, has this he wrote about the 30 rungs of the ladder towards spiritual ascension.
Uh-huh.
And as spiritual seekers climb every rung, there are demons who attempt to tear that person down. And it's that struggle towards a spiritual ideal.
Mm-hmm.
There's the ultimate perfection of moral character.
Okay.
That is the life's purpose. It sounds all pretty heavy, right?
Well, not really. I mean, it
makes sense.
It's a little lofty, but not in a bad way.
Right.
So it's essentially about the dissonance between the animal body and the spiritual mind.
Right.
Hey everyone, it's Craig with this episode's very special interruption, and Brian and I would like to ask you to please take a survey that will help our prospective advertisers get a better sense of who our audience is. We're talking to a variety of people, and we want to make sure we have the right match for our show and our listeners. So the survey is at http://survey.libsyn.com/whimsically-volatile. We'll also have it in the episode description for this episode and also on our Twitter. It would be tremendously helpful for us. We really appreciate your support. Thank you so much. And back to the show.
You know, like from a Freudian point of view, it's coming to terms with the id, coming to terms with this beastly nature, our animal nature, the urges. You know, and as the ego or the self is trying to reckon with that, and also with the conscience, the superego of guilt.
Sure.
And shame.
Yeah.
And I find myself in the strange position of a void of fear and also a void of shame.
But that's a gradual process, right? Getting rid of the shame.
It's a lifelong process for some people. I took the fast track because I'm an overachiever.
Yeah.
I'm an overachiever. And
you're coming in hot.
I'm coming in hot. We're jamming in dry. We're pulling out wet. But I've always been an overachiever. I was forced into a very painful and stark reckoning of my past and the wreckage that I've wreaked on other people and on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had to like kind of unironically just really face the facts is that I'm a bull in a china shop.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm a bull. I'm a bully. I bully myself into submission every day because I have a ruthless and sometimes very self-righteous pursuit of perfect moral character.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I've had to recommend the fact that I've imposed that on people that I've worked with,
mm-hmm.
that I've had relationships with, but I've never developed the coping skills to clearly, honestly, deliberately, and compassionately voice my needs and desires in terms of these relationships.
And that could be a really big problem.
That is a huge problem. And it became a perfect, there is one thing led to another and to another, and all of this little additions and the accumulation of all of these scenarios and relationships, it just blew up into my face in the most spectacularly horrifying way. I wreaked havoc, and there was a great deal of shrapnel.
Sure.
Collateral damage.
Yeah.
All because of my, because I never learned the appropriate way to communicate sincerely what I want, what I need, and what I deserve.
Because that seems so scary many times.
Yeah.
Most of the time, really. For some reason, it seems like the scariest thing to do.
I think that it was the scariest thing to do for me because I am by my nature a peacemaker and a people pleaser.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm the middle child.
Okay.
And I've always wanted everybody to like me.
Uh-huh.
And that insecure urge manifests in me wanting to placate other people's desires, to always say yes to everything.
Subsume your own interests.
Exactly. To say, no, you're not important. As long as everybody's having a good time, you don't matter.
Sure.
And then I found myself in the eye of this perfect storm where everywhere I looked, I was like, fuck, I don't want to be here.
Yeah, that's a drag.
I don't want to be here. I don't want this relationship. I don't want that. And I was like, fuck. And it was this huge burden.
Yeah.
That I was carrying around. And then I realized, oh my God, you can just drop it.
Which it doesn't seem like you can at the time.
No.
I found myself in a similar thing at times. And yeah, you think it feels like everything's too webbed together, that there's no escaping from it, because all of this inattention really has led to this prison.
Yeah. It's the mind is a prison, and I searched for power and pleasure outside of myself so many times that, and I just got caught up.
Yeah.
And I realized that I am the only one in control of my life situation.
That's true.
And it's a life situation is certainly just that. It's the humility that comes with the humility that we can experience by realizing that we're just another bozo on the bus of life.
Yeah.
That we're actually not even really driving the bus. That it's not like they have an expression, you know, let go and let God, which to a lot of people who are non-spiritual folk kind of see as just giving, relinquishing control wholesale. That's really not what it is.
Sure.
It's saying you put your best foot forward, but you have to let go of results.
Yeah.
And let the chips fall where they may.
Right. You have to do your part, but then the universe ultimately will do what it will do.
Yeah, totally.
And that's
life.
Right.
And that's how the story goes. And that's how the stories always went. And for me, because I was able to like kind of more accurately assess my knowledge, talent, and experience as it relates to my profession, to my relationships, and to my general well-being.
Yeah.
I was able to say, oh fuck, you know, I actually know all there is to know. I need to unclutter and uncover my sort of true nature and desires in order for me to just plain old feel good.
Right. Because if you don't feel good, then that's when self-abuses start.
Sure.
And that's when also you start getting mad at others.
Yep.
And resentful.
Yep.
And, you know, which sometimes is justified, but a lot of times it's all about you being mad at the fact that you've let yourself be in this position.
Exactly. And that was, I projected all of my bullshit anger onto my coworkers, my colleagues, my relationships. I spared my family, thank God, because I have an unreasonably excellent family. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, but even with that, you know, people, we've all got our stories. We've all got our gory stories about how we were abused, how we were victimized, how we were taken advantage of. Listen, I've been raped. You know, I've been, betrayed. I've abused myself. I've been abused by others, blah, 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 blah. My hiding from that pain is not it's not like, I sort of had to reckon with the fact that I've dealt with it. I've processed it.
Yeah.
Now just move the fuck on.
Yeah. Moving on is a
moving
very important piece to all this. Yeah.
Moving on. There's a great expression. We don't wish to shut the door on the past or regret it.
Yeah.
We don't regret the past, but we don't wish to shut the door on it, which means that we can forgive and we can, not forget, but we can use that information in order to push ahead.
Yeah.
But we don't just barrel forward, leaving a train of wreckage, which is what I've had to do. I remember in seventh grade is such a psychosocial developmental stage for a lot of people in America. And, a lot of people that I've talked to, my experience of seventh grade was that I didn't learn a damn thing in school, but I learned a lot about people.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's all about this, socialization and not really about book smarts, you know? But I remember one time I had like three close friends. Let's say they're like Stacy, Catherine, and Barbara.
Sure. Hi, Stacy, Catherine, Barbara.
Hey guys, how are you? Well, I talked to Stacy about Catherine. Uh-huh. I talked to Catherine about Barbara. Uh-huh. I talked to Barbara about Stacy.
Sure.
And then, you know, shit talking, backstabbing as it were, you know, of course for a seventh grader, it's not very reasonable to expect open and honest lines of communication in terms of emotional intelligence
or really a proper level of discretion.
Right. But snitches get stitches, Craig. Yes. And I don't like a snitch regardless of that. They snitched on to each other about me and it all blew up spectacularly in my face. And that's when I learned that the first time I learned that if you got a problem with somebody, you got two choices, forget about it or talk to them about it.
Right.
And I found myself recently in a situation where I was so unwilling to voice my dissent and my distaste and my lack of pleasure in the activities that I was embroiled in and the relationships that I felt stuck in, that I wasn't able to say, hey, you know, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
And hey, this is actually not worth it for me anymore. And also, this is the last one that's really tough. Hey, I love you. I wish you all the best, but I just don't like you.
Yeah. That's a tough one sometimes.
That's the really hard one. Because when you look at, when you go down the ledger and people, you know, it's really kind of humorless and dry to kind of, to take stock or inventory of all your relationships and see like, where was I? How much did I give? Did I get it in return? You know, it all kind of comes out in the wash because it's really your perception versus the other person's perception. And that's all subject to so many factors. But if you allow, like I allowed myself to stay in relationships that really just didn't serve me at all. And then, and I look back and they were the wrong ones to choose from the jump.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. They're never, when I think it's a weird thing that you realize later and more usually later in life that when you're feeling like, I don't know about this, it's a big sign that you really should pay attention to.
Yeah. I had a boyfriend, a short relationship with this kid who, he was much younger than me. But he was a really smart guy. Mm-hmm. And, I gotta tell you, it was the most, I look back at this short, but very meaningful relationship with this guy. And he, I'm so in awe of his grace because I've always struggled with substances since I was about 16.
Yeah.
And, we dated and then, I remember I relapsed and, we were supposed to hang out, and I called him, and I texted him, and I said, I admitted that I had relapsed.
Yeah.
And I just fully expected him to, I was almost like I was trying to block him out. I was like, listen, I did this thing. I'm so ashamed. I can't see you. He ran to my house and was like, I was like, what are you doing here? But he ran into the fire.
Right.
Because he cared about me that much. And I was like, holy shit, I don't deserve this guy. This is incredible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, later on he was so willing to see me through this difficult time that I was like, holy fuck, that is the true nature of love.
Yeah.
And then I fucked it up royally after that. You know, and he said, and he gave me the grace of saying goodbye.
How did it go?
He recognized the fact that I was nuts. Uh-huh. He tried and tried and tried.
Yeah.
He got guidance from peers, from family, he was like, listen, I don't understand what to do right now. I'm going to go try to figure it out, and I'll come back to you. Like, it was like one of the most bizarrely mature styles of communication that I was completely disarmed by.
Yeah.
I was like, holy fuck, this kid has evolved. You know, and he was only like 25. I mean, I remember, and that's how shitty of a boyfriend I am. But it was like, I was like, wow, this kid is legit.
Yeah.
And I'm so in awe of that. That was one of the most beautiful experiences of the relationships that I've ever had. And I've had very few of them. I've had maybe like 5 boyfriends in my life or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was a crazy thing. And it really reinforced the importance of, you want to grow up, you got to talk about your fucking shit.
Right.
And you got to do it in a way that you got to try your best, because Lord knows I fucking failed at it so many times. But the thing about me is I don't feel embarrassed about anything anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't feel ashamed. So I just share it, because I want people to, if they can learn something from it, I want them to.
What also helps you too, to talk about it.
Yeah. It's very therapeutic. I don't,
which is not a bad thing, by the way.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. And like what I remember just from what Devin was talking about, most people aren't listening, you know, in the day to day humdrum, like goings on of life. That's when I learned that's what really cured me of, a lot of, public speaking fear.
Uh-huh.
I remember I was in a meeting once, and the guy to my right, and this was in a meeting of a 12-step meeting, and the guy to my right was so, I mean, I was afraid to share.
Okay.
Because it's very, it's tough.
It's daunting.
It's daunting. It's terrifying. It's,
and how early had you been to a lot of meetings before, or was this sort of new in the process?
No, I had gone to meetings for a year already.
Oh, okay.
You know? And,
so it still stayed with you even up till then.
Oh yeah. And I know people who go to meetings and they are terrified to share even 5 years in.
Wow.
You know, it depends on the format. Sometimes you got to go up to a podium and speak in front of 300 people.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
In meetings are all different. You know, depending on the group, depending on what kind of whatever, and it doesn't even matter about recovery. I'm talking about a business meeting or a presentation at work,
right?
You know, but this kid to my right, he was sitting. I noticed he was sweating, like profusely, and he looked like he was about to undergo a full tilt meltdown.
Uh-huh.
And seeing him afraid like that instantly evaporated any anxiety I had.
Right.
Because I realized, oh fuck, everybody's the same.
Sure.
Everybody's extremely terrified of saying the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Saying the inappropriate thing and appearing stupid, weak, and whatever.
No, you're right. Once you realize, it's easy to forget that, but once you realize that in any situation like that, a social setting, you know, going to an unfamiliar a party or something.
House party, yep.
Yeah, especially a house party, because there's this strange confluence of intimacy and strangers. Do you know what I mean? So you know someone, but you don't know all the others.
Yep.
Or anything like that. You just realize everyone feels that same way.
Everybody's, and we are social creatures who are so flawed. That is our nature. And we all want to be involved. We all want to be liked. We all want to be loved and accepted. And, but in I found that the primary mental dysfunction surrounding anxiety is the inability to realize that everybody feels that way.
Sure.
Everybody does. It's like even the most, you know, and then the qualities that we identify as shitty in others is often due to defense mechanisms built up around containing that anxiety.
Uh-huh.
Like the guy who won't shut the fuck up.
Right.
You know, or the asshole just barrels into the room with no respect or couth or courtesy.
Yeah.
You know, it's all just a big, stupid dance. And everybody sucks at it.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I was recently at a friend's birthday party, and for some reason, it just was one of those days where I felt like a little bit of social anxiety. I knew a lot of the people there, but then I didn't know half the people there. So, but then I discovered she was going through the same thing, and it was her party.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nobody, I mean, I say nobody cares kind of as a flip. It's kind of flippant and glib as I say that, but what I mean is that it's not a big deal. Like
no one's pointing at you and laughing.
That's that. And I've had that. I mean, I've experienced so many shameful moments where I've bombed, where I've said something that is totally off base or yeah. I remember when we used to host the drag show back at Jock's.
Yeah.
I hosted that show and I was way too lazy to write monologues. Like I just never liked, I never enjoyed or practiced the discipline of sitting down at a computer or with a notebook and writing down jokes and writing down a story. I loved improvising it. And whenever I would get ready for the show, I would shave in the shower and take these long, like 30 minute showers and try to go over what I was like, kind of general gist of what I wanted.
Yeah.
And sometimes it bombed spectacularly. Many times it did, but sometimes you catch the rhythm of the crowd and the energy and it goes and you kill it.
Yeah.
And that is just magical.
I think that's true of every performance, like stand-up comedy or DJing or whatever.
Sure.
Sometimes you connect with the room and sometimes you do not.
No.
But right. Of course, I remember seeing those performances and I thought they were incredible. I thought they were, especially one where you weren't prepared to do anything except someone was like 10 to 15 minutes late and they were dragging their ass. So you came out on stage and just like killed with just this stream of consciousness bit that laid everyone out.
Well, that's what I like. And that's also it's the thrill of performing that I fell in love with was improv, is that it's a skill that's groomed over time and time and like with anything, if we're so afraid to fail, the fear of failure is really tied so closely with this kind of like fear of success.
Sure.
You know, and it's, I don't know. It's, I'm not afraid of anything anymore. And that's a very disorienting feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not, I don't have time for it.
So you don't feel any kind of anxiety about anything or?
No. Now that's easy for me to say because I've achieved a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Like I realize that I can be impatient and insensitive and very much a bully towards others' feelings because I've gone through a lot of shit myself in terms of successes and failures, both personally and professionally, that I just don't have a lot of time for it. I've bombed a million times. Mm-hmm. I've showed up for work completely unprepared and just did it anyways. I've gone out on a limb. I've given too much. I've taken too much. I've done all this crap. It's not that I don't get nervous, like for the stage. I don't give a fuck.
Well, yeah, you've passed the point of it. Not that it's just a job, and I don't mean it like that.
No, because it's not just a job.
It's not. But no. When you're doing something for so often and so intensely, it just becomes what you do.
Yeah. I go like, particularly in drag, like after Drag Race, the hardest thing about that job, because I was a very popular Drag Race alumna, you know, and I enjoyed a lot of success from a very favorable presentation on the show on two seasons. And what I enjoyed was an almost unconditional love of the crowd, which is not afforded to many performers.
It's true. Yeah.
And many of my colleagues were very jealous of that. And, you know, which is so relatable, you know, it's like, because Drag Race gives you a gift. But it's not just a gift that you don't, I mean, you have to do the work.
Well, yeah, it's a two-way street.
It's always a two-way street. And it's like, you know, people love to blame the editing. My personal take on that is that you have total control over what comes out of your mouth.
That's right.
that is just the ticket. And for me on Drag Race, my experience was more about restraint than caution and a self-consciousness. Although the first time on Drag Race was completely just nerve-wracking. The second time was much less so, but I enjoyed, a favorable edit because I gave what I believed to be the appropriate amount of myself.
Sure.
You know, I shared what was on my mind. I tried to be as creative as I could under the pressure, yada, yada, yada. I tried to choose the best outfits and I got whatever.
Well, you also weren't trying to put on some kind of facade.
No. And actually,
when people do that, that's when they start blaming the edit because when people in any form, actually, you could say this about life too, really. Isn't Drag Race just a big metaphor for life, ladies and gentlemen?
Well, you say that's a cliche, but I think it's totally true.
No, I'm saying it because it's true though. Because when people try to produce themselves and put on an air to sort of look a certain way, right?
Yeah.
It never works. There's a great Gary Shandling documentary called The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, made by Judd Apatow. It's on HBO. A lot of the things we're talking about are floated through there. And he had this note to himself that was just about, he said, just be the most Gary you can be.
Yeah.
Because there were times where he couldn't get out of the car after a show because he was so depressed from the failure. Yeah. The bombing was so severe, but you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And then like any stand-up comic that you know, like you were saying before, you just walk on the stage.
You just do it.
Yeah.
You just fucking do it. And I have a lot of, I mean, people want to talk about bombing. Oh, come talk to me. Because listen, I watched a little snippet of the Hey Queen show, and Vicky Vox was on it. And she's a very real character. She's a very real person, and she kind of tells it like it is. And she's very self-deprecating about the quality of her drag, but not about her talent level, which is real. And for me, drag was a way to kind of exorcise the need for perfection and the need for a perfect performance.
Yeah.
It was the ephemeral nature of performance art in a drag queen, the ephemeral nature of drag in a performance art context, without being too pretentious, is that life is a joke. Gender is mutable. So let's have some fucking fun.
Right.
You know, but, it's better to know your words than to not, you know?
Right.
And it's better to have an idea, have an improvisational structure that can give the audience some semblance of a good piece of entertainment.
Yeah.
And better yet, if you rehearse the whole damn thing, great. Rehearse it a million times. That's not my style. Because I never got paid that much, like before Drag Race.
Just wasn't your style.
Yeah, it wasn't my style.
You couldn't, when you're not unable, but when you're so not willing to sit down and write something, but you're able to go on stage and just freeform it.
Yeah.
That's just your style.
That's my style. And that's because I love the tension. My creative brain really kicks into high gear when the tension is taut.
Sure.
You know, when it's like, because the stakes are high. When you get on stage and you're not prepared, that's a fucking ballsy move.
It's a bit of a rush.
It's a huge rush. It's a euphoric. And when you hit it,
right,
it's so euphoric. But I see so many people trying to, like, they really have to stick to the script no matter what.
Yeah.
And that to me is a refusal to adjust and adhere to the energetic flow of the crowd.
Right.
You know,
there's this
like notion of like, do I pander to what they want? Do I just give them what they want? But that's patronizing, of course, to your crowd. Or do I ruthlessly cling to what I perceive to be funny no matter what the cost?
Yeah. Right.
You know,
like be the most Gary you can be the most Brian you can be at all times.
Yeah. My style is to, like, you know, it depends on who the crowd is. I don't ever watch my performances.
Right.
Ever. Like, I don't never, you know, I hate that they're all up on YouTube.
But did you ever used to?
No, never.
Really?
Never. I remember back in Perestroika, some of the girls always were clamoring for me to get a videographer, and I never wanted to, although we did usually videotape the anniversary shows because those were the ones with the most production value. And the two performances that I think are the best I've ever done in drag were the Titanic one. It was an anniversary show where I built a boat, and I did the Russian version of the song My Heart Will Go On.
Right.
And then the other one was when I was as with the homage to Becca DeBus, who had left to Singapore. to Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus, and me and Madge of Honor was the ghost behind the machine doing the little bubble tears and this, and it was just so, you know, and it was like that, those moments were so precious because we worked so hard in this you know, this lowbrow vaudevillian context, and it was just like so such magic.
Yeah.
But most of the time we just like, you just wing it in drag. Right. I remember I hope she doesn't mind me calling her out, but Nicole Pryde used to get so like just twisted up if like she went out on stage and her shoe broke or something.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And she would just get in a tizzy. And we're all like, girl, just take it easy. It's Jacques Cabaret. It's a lip sync number. Half the audience is dead drunk. Nobody cares. And it's because for me, the most important part of drag was if something doesn't go wrong, well, you're not really doing drag. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
It's like, this is not, we're not at the, we're not at the Royal Ballet.
Right.
You know, this is not ABT.
Yeah.
This is not Juilliard. We're not trained thespians, darling.
Yes, darling.
We're just a bunch of pigs in wigs and we're shucking and jiving for some hot, sweaty cash, you know? And it's, it was that if you were, like we've said before, it's like you were either there or you weren't. And it was just, and nobody was videotaping. Mm-hmm. Nobody was really videotaping on their phones back then. It was just like.
Well, Pablo snuck some great footage. Pablo Milan. Shout out to Pablo Milan and James Derek Dwyer.
Yes, they, you know, always
that,
did.
Well, and also that's how we got that footage of you doing Pussy Good, Pussy Sweet with that religious monologue.
Oh, yeah. Tamara Lowe, that religious rap that I probably listened to 472 times to get it just right.
Really? I just thought you heard it once. We're like, I got it. Well,
I got it. No, but I love that. And I, you know, it's just so funny how it's so interesting to see how drag has changed. And, you know, I, like I haven't quit drag. It's just, I've sort of reframed my perspective about what is, why it's important to me.
Yeah.
And it's, it has something to do with just, allowing myself to kind of, think about it in a lofty way without worrying about sounding pretentious.
Yeah, that's good. Once you rid yourself of that fear of coming across pretentious, because who fucking cares?
Yeah. You know, I have to say, I kind of, when Sasha Velour came on to, when she was, she came through the workroom on season 9 and she described herself as a straight up artist, I kind of bristled a little bit, only because it just seemed like she didn't have much of a sense of humor about her.
Uh-huh.
But the fact of the matter is she is a legitimate artist.
Sure.
Her aesthetic sense is extremely,
refined. Yeah.
And that bitch is a fucking artist. Like same with like Violet Chachki.
Sure.
These are artists.
Yeah. And also one thing that I always noted with Violet is the confidence level.
Yeah.
Because she seemed to have figured out the thing. It's like, listen, I'm not going to just throw my chances away or my day away on being insecure or anxious.
No.
She walks into the room and she's her. She's that.
She owned it.
Yeah.
She owned it. And, you know, she'll tell you, she's like, I remember I learned this from my friend, Megan Clute, and she's another thrill seeker and a fear chaser. And, she went at 16, she went to, you know, she went to live in, Barcelona to learn Spanish. Then she flew to Cambodia, didn't know any of it, just learned language there. Then she got into hang gliding, broke both of her humerus bones in a huge crash once. And she's like, you know,
is that the funny bone, the humerus bone?
You are rotten. That is wretched.
Sorry.
You know, but she was.
Shout out to Captain Kidney. Yeah. Sorry, and darling, you said not to do any of this on this show.
Darling, you promised we wouldn't go in a tangent.
Oh, God damn it.
Oh, ladies and tangents.
My fault this time. Yes.
Dear anyway. Ladies and tangents, we will reconvene at once.
So back to your friend Megan.
No, she was fearless.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, you know, she acknowledged the fact that she's like, you don't think I'm afraid when I do this shit?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I'm fucking terrified. What's the difference? I do it. Anyways,
I was talking to someone who should have been doing more with their gift than they were.
Sure.
And it's a very tricky thing because when you're trying to tell someone like you're wasting time, why are you not shining like you should be?
Yeah.
It's tough because you're walking a line between trying to be encouraging. Sometimes it's like you're trying to tell them what to do. And, but you ultimately just want them to sort of flex and do their thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they said something like, well, it's really scary. It's really hard for me. It's really. And I was like, do you think what I do is like, do you think I just like, oh, I have no thoughts in the world. I have no cares in the world about what I do. Or like, I don't know, doing a show or doing a gig or whatever, right? Pick whatever it is, or going to for a meeting with some, you know, very important person that to talk about a project. It's all scary. That's the sign that it's something that you want to do.
Yeah. And that's the sign that there's going to be some kind of growth, development, and learning.
Yeah. Because if you're not a little, if you don't have a little bit of trepidation about something, or if you're not like, gee, I sure, am I doing this right? It's never wrong to think, am I doing this right? That's right. Not that, that's an acceptable,
yeah.
I guess, flavor of anxiety.
Totally. Just
thinking like, do I have this right? Wait, maybe I should check going over it and all that stuff. That's all right. All
yeah, that's stuff. Doing your homework.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
But it's the thing about getting through that fear or saying, I feel this way, but it doesn't matter. Feeling socially anxious.
Yeah.
I feel uptight, but you know what? I'm not going to leave. Right. I'm not just going to run home and then think, oh, I should have stayed there. I'm going to stay. And either I'm going to work through it. Maybe it'll dissolve in 10 minutes. Maybe it won't.
Maybe it won't. Right. And sometimes, like I have like experienced recently with some relationships, I had to say goodbye and I was too, you know, in a sense, I was a little bit, I could think of it as chicken shit, or I can think of it as just unwilling or whatever to give reasons, explanations, and justifications. Sometimes you just got to clean, you know, make a clean break. Sometimes you realize you just got to change course.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a, I think that, you know, giving yourself, it's the balance of giving yourself a break, but also not allowing yourself to fester in a pool of stagnation.
That's true, which can also come about because you're worried about what the other person's right. going to feel. And also you're sort of making that up in your mind.
Totally.
So a lot of that is just fantasy anyway, yeah. because yeah. sometimes those big discussions that you dread having, oh my God, it's going to be so bad. You actually have them and they're not as bad.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. I mean, I found when I had in a recovery programs, often there's a process of reckoning with some of the really horrific shit you've done and making amends to it. And now making amends is a very different from giving an apology, by the way.
Okay.
So there's the main difference between saying I'm sorry and making an amends is action.
Okay.
So, you
an
know,
example maybe.
Well, it's like, for example, I had to face certain people and
that
say,
that was the couch telling yeah, you, please do your, not yeah, get your goddamn your, shoes off the fucking couch.
Squeaky wheel gets the grease.
It's like, No.
See, I'm such a bully. I'm bullying the couch. No, but I had to face up to the fact that I stole a lot of money from some people and I had to go and tell them like, hey, you know, sorry, won't pay back the bills.
That's true. That's
and I had true. To say, I had to do say, hey, you didn't know this, but I stole all this money from you.
Yeah.
And if you agree to it on your terms and on your, on a timeline that you find reasonable, I am more than willing to pay all this back plus interest.
Okay. So the key aspect of that is you have to factor in the other person's comfort,
their comfort, their needs, their, you have
ethos,
to meet
everything.
You got to meet them on their level, on sure. their terms, because it's rectifying a huge violation of trust.
Right.
And
so it's not about what you want, what you need.
Absolutely yeah. not. And then there's always a caveat that you don't contact that person if you're going to just incur additional damage.
Okay.
Right.
Sure.
Sometimes you just got to walk away and don't do any more harm.
Right. Right.
You know, and that's the one that I have the most trouble with, because I'm of the very self-flagellating nature.
Sure.
Where it's like, okay, I wasn't able to say what I really felt in this instance. Well, maybe it's not going to be good to say it now. So just get the fuck out of there, Nancy, and keep on pressing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's unfortunate. But sometimes people, you know, I always felt that closure is just a fantasy.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, oh God, if I only knew what he really felt, or if da, 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 da. It's like, you know what? Closure is for movies.
Sure, right.
And for stories.
Sometimes things are just over.
Sometimes things are over. Sometimes they were way over. Sometimes you let them steamroll in a snowball, and you just got to hop off the train.
And sometimes it's strange for us to think, oh, wait, there's two options here. One of them would just be a non-event.
Yeah.
Or the other one would be some kind of event, like an upset or a...
Or like a duel.
Yeah, or like some kind of ugly adrenaline rush.
Right. Yeah. What are you really doing this for? Are you doing it for revenge?
Yeah.
For relief? Or are you doing it for restitution?
Right.
You know, and are you doing it to, this is what, you know, I ultimately, you know, it's you can find patterns of behavior. And I've been noticing too, it's my people pleasing and my inability to establish clear boundaries from the step one of a relationship or before that, whether it's a business relationship or personal one, a friendship, a roommate or a lover, is that like, what the fuck do I really want here?
Yeah.
Am I just doing this to do it? Am I doing it because it's convenient? Am I doing it because I can't ask for the proper help?
Sure.
Or am I really unclear about what I actually want? And then I'm just accepting something that's going to hurt me or delving back into a familiar pattern where I'm going to cause destruction. And it's like, fuck, you know, add drugs to the mix and then you have no choices.
The danger of convenience is a big,
yep.
big danger. Oh, well, this person's here or this situation's here. I guess for now, a lot of that for now stuff is actually just settling.
Yeah. And also, oh, I've known this person forever. It's all going to work out.
Oh, right.
You know, just because this person has been in my life for X amount of years doesn't mean the relationship can't end.
And also, yeah, right. Exactly. Because you see this a lot of people just because they're like, well, but I've known them for so long. That doesn't mean
that. Doesn't matter.
Anything.
It doesn't matter. I've had relationships in my life where we've never even had 5 minutes of open, clear, sincere, honest communication.
Yeah.
And that's due to a whole host of factors on each side. But guess what? Sometimes they're just not worth salvaging.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's painful and it's shitty. And often they end in a way that's not really fair. And it's not really mature.
Yeah.
And it's not really good. But it's like, ever since I really kind of had that psychotic fucking breakdown and I'm just like, you know what? It's just life's too short.
It is.
It's just too damn short. And you know, we can argue, you know, people, you don't, the thing I always think about is like, you get to decide if you're good.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to decide if you're great. That's what I believe because if you're so concerned about being perfect,
being the
best and being people pleasing, you're just going to end up a martyr.
Yeah, it's true. And ultimately dissatisfied.
And you know, cause people, for me personally, I've noticed that because I have a bright, positive energy most of the time.
Yeah.
And a seemingly endless store of it.
Sure.
I have to be vigilant and disciplined about turning off the tap.
Sure, right. Because there's also plenty of people who will just take.
But that's the nature of people.
Not all people though. That's what I mean.
But that is in our nature too. When somebody gives you a gift, the natural thing is like, oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, cool. I want that.
Sure.
Thank you. And then, but you can't get raw about not getting a gift back.
Right.
Cause that's what ended up happening to me is like, I made all this money and I was, over tipping and being too generous because like that because I like to be generous, but.
And also you had a long period of time where that wasn't a possibility, right?
So, I mean, I worked check to check for so many years. And then when I started to bring home the bacon and kind of MC Hammer all my goods and assets.
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, I don't want an entourage. But also I've had to reckon with my inability to, my extremely passive aggressive pattern of asking for help and then rejecting it.
Okay. So how would that manifest?
Well, I'll tell you, Craig.
Do enlighten me. Pardon me, Brian. Yeah. Please tell me.
How about scheduling a one-woman show called Help Me, I'm Dying, and then postponing it because I almost died?
Okay. So that's how you would term that, the seeking help and then refusing
like,
it.
Like hiring the wrong people because I didn't vet them.
Sure.
Sleeping with the help. Shitting where I eat.
Right.
Not trusting my instincts. And that last one is the biggest takeaway for me.
Mm-hmm.
When my body is free of substances that are destructive to me.
Yeah.
I have such a clear and, formidable connection to an intuitive instinct that always serves me right.
Yeah.
You know, it's always about compassion, lightness, justice, creativity, and joy.
Mm-hmm.
But once I put those drugs in, I can't make good decisions.
Right.
Because I'm so hopped up and jacked or dissociated or hypnotized or dickmatized or whatever-matized that I'm like, I just want to people please, or I just want to please myself and shut everybody out.
Yeah.
Or I don't want to face facts and own up to what I've done or what I'm about to do. And it all becomes this bizarre mind game, shit storm, drivel mess drama.
Yeah. It's like chutes and ladders over and over.
And it's awful. And I recently put a lot of people through hell. You know, and, but I do, but, and the thing, you know, reckoning with it publicly is that I really feel the need to keep it private.
Right.
And it, I know it's like it, another like passive aggressive, like narcissistic,
no, not necessarily. Mindfuck.
You don't think so?
No. You mean talking about it like
right,
this?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so whatsoever. You know, it's okay to talk about things in a very vague and general nature because you're talking about the actual subjects of, or rather the contents of the conversation. You don't have to say who was talking. You know?
Because I, the one thing that I'm really, that I find distasteful, and that I'm certainly, I've been guilty of, I try my best always, and I'm not, you know, I'm very hyper self-conscious of this ability to like be, to appear like play the victim. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really don't want to do that, but, I have to be hyper vigilant about, respecting people's privacy, not being intentionally malicious, because that's not my nature naturally. But I have to be really, really forceful and determined and disciplined in drawing boundaries as for particular relationships as they apply to those relationships, and not make any grand, frothy, emotional pronouncements wholesale, you know, where I reject things wholesale.
Or like rigid rules that apply to everything across the board.
No, because I take everything as it comes. And unfortunately, I don't nip things in the bud when it's appropriate. I allow it to fester and snowball, and then it just blows up into a big shitstorm.
I would say that's fairly a common
malady. It is a common
malady,
thing.
You know?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, these things happen all the time because, and I have to realize, like, I became a small business overnight.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I own a small business. I own an LLC. And, you know, I have to watch out for my business, the preservation of my business and my money. And I have to stick to ethical standards of business conduct that perhaps other people don't share, but it's my responsibility to, when I engage with other people in symbiotic business relationships, let's define the parameters right up front and then decide if this is going to be a profitable business scenario for both of us.
Because too often the impulse is to not, oh, we'll deal with that later because it's too icky and I don't want to.
Exactly. And then, exactly. And like, or, you know, like this happens with roommates. It happens with relationships. This happens with, and especially if you're the type of person who wants to like, have it all, where it's like, okay, I want my boyfriend to be also my business partner. Or I want my husband or wife to, we want to be a team.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that gets messy real fucking quick.
It does. Yeah.
And I remember the first manager I had, the first booking agent I had said to me, very clearly, don't worry about, you know, if you outgrow me, just tell me and you can move on. And that happened. And guess what? He did not take that very well. And, you know, and I had to hold him to that, but I did not yet have the balls to say, hey, remember that thing you said?
Right.
Why don't we start practicing what we preach and let me go gently and compassionately and with justice in mind?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but listen, the business world is fraught with horrible situations gone awry.
Yeah, yeah.
But I, you know, it's all a learning curve, and sometimes it's just a, they're just facing up to really difficult decisions. I have a, you know, in terms of business and employers and employees relationships, I have a track record of having really horrible bosses that I've, you know, who have kind of like, you know, working either for corporations or working for private owners.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have not learned from the best.
Sure.
So having to make your own rules and forge ahead in the business world is something that is very challenging, and it's an ongoing process, and there's not a lot of great advice out there for it.
Right. No, that's true.
You know,
especially when your learning curve is so short, because overnight,
you have to be your own boss, your own this, your own that. And with the drag race stardom, we're really saddled with a lot of tough decisions every single day about how to manage our business.
Right.
And, nobody knows what they're doing. That's the true fact.
Yeah,
nobody
knows. True.
Nobody knows what we're doing. Everybody's out to catch a piece, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody's out to catch a piece. Everybody wants to be a promoter. Everybody wants to be a wig stylist. Everybody wants to be in on the action.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And they want to get in on the ground floor, and then everybody feels betrayed or double crossed, or
they expect something that is not, is a fantasy,
right?
And then they get mad at you because you didn't provide them with that full-on fantasy. Yeah.
Right. And the thing is that, like, what I've had to realize is I've always bristled at the unironic assumptions, or like saying like, my brand is this,
that
I've always kind of like rejected that that language, because it just always seemed so corny.
Sure.
But, you know, I've butted heads with some people, in the drag world just because I'm a wild bitch, you know, and that's what drag has always meant to me. Like,
yeah,
drag was never that serious in terms of the technical performance of entertainment. It's like
rigid.
It's like, this is not the Boston Philharmonic.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
right.
There's no, it like, you know, drag time is real and there are divas and we're, you know, it's trying to, I feel like a lot of times people are trying to make drag into something way more big than it is performance wise.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of tension there. Like you know, I remember I was like fired from a gig for being a wild, out of control, drug crazed bitch.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the consequence of being who I am.
Sure.
And it's funny when I remember that night later, I was fired from the show very unceremoniously I was fired. It was totally fair and square.
Yeah.
And I realized that I was like, oh shit, you know, I have been using these substances to cope with this unmanageable tour schedule that I have myself encouraged.
Gotcha. Yeah, absolutely.
But when I saw the promoters later that night, I was like, thank you so much for firing me.
Yeah.
I literally said those words. I was like, thank you so much for firing me. Now I can just take the rest of this time off. And they're like, what the fuck is wrong with this bitch?
Right. Right. Well, but again, you're in a situation where you don't want to say no to these gigs. Cause for so long it was hard to get major gigs. Not that it was hard to get gigs.
It was hard. I mean, for the longest time there were no gigs.
Like, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. there was nothing.
So someone says, well, you're going to do 35 of these at X dollar a night. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Okay. Whatever. Yeah. Sure. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, absolutely. And it was, you just do the gigs. And then I realized, I was like, okay, you know, what is the difference between $300,000 and $400,000?
What's $100,000? Don't you know that?
What are you, a goddamn mathematician now, Craig? But it was like, you know, there, I was like,
I have a calculator, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. You can't see that. So anyway.
For the listeners at home, there's a TI-82 here. Texas Instruments graphing calculator. I was like, so am I doing this for the money?
Yeah.
Well, the money didn't make me happy. Am I doing it for the fame and the love? Well, that ultimately wasn't satisfying. Mm-hmm. What am I doing this for? Am I doing it to run myself into the ground? Am I doing it to be the best? Am I doing it to be the most beloved? I had am I doing it to be included?
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, well, no, I mean, none of these things really matter at the end of the day if you're not sane, safe, and happy.
Right. If you don't feel good, nothing matters.
Nothing matters. Nothing matters. Then you're just chasing the almighty dollar like every other capitalist pig in America.
Right.
I'm a socialist. Mm. Like, I am a socialist. You know, I want everybody to be able to eat. Every sure. single fucking person in America should have access to food, water, shelter, and clothing.
Yeah.
Point blank, cut and dry,
yeah.
Bottom line.
Right.
You know, sometimes I've had to push back or pull away from certain relationships that are just motivated by straight up greed mm-hmm. in the service of, oh, it's a sisterhood. Well, you know, that doesn't really jive with me because I have longevity in mind. Not longevity of the sisterhood or the franchise of Drag Race, but longevity of performance entertainment as it relates to drag.
Yeah.
And you know, it just seems like this big bubble and it's everybody's trying to milk it for all it's worth at the expense of the quality of it. And now granted, I can't speak for great quality on stage because I'm a fucking mess, but it's also just a really difficult thing to reckon with the past as it relates. I mean, because now I'm still very much, it's all fresh, all the breaking you know, the taking a break is something that's very foreign to me. But I love drag because I love it as an underground subcultural expression of queer outcast identities. I love it as a countercultural sporting event.
Yeah.
But to me, it was always about the thing that I don't like now is that it just seems to be about the surface. And it's like when all you have is people arguing about who did this eyebrow shape first, and you know who did this first. I was like, this is not what drag is about.
Right.
You know, drag is a vaudevillian theatrical performance that is part and parcel of the queer underground community.
Yeah.
I mean, that's drag in America. And like, you know, when it's just about like, so like, which makeup company do you think has the best like luminescent eyeshadow?
Yeah.
Like, which one? And then there's all this call out culture and this outrage on social media about who did what and who did this and who's the original, you know, and who's a bad person and who's rude at their meet and greets and who's not grateful for the opportunities and and who's a real diva behind the scenes and who stole this act. And, you know, it's all a bunch of petty drama and nonsense that I got a little bit in the middle of, and you know, and that's never really been my thing. Cause I just appreciate, I just love the, I don't know.
The freedom
I just love the wildness of it.
Yeah.
You know, drag was always a wild and crazy thing. It was always confrontational. Excuse me. It was always, sorry. Drag for me was always controversial, confrontational, and ephemeral. We're back. Here we are.
And we wanted to talk a little bit about speaking from the heart.
Speaking from the sincerity, the lost art form of open-hearted comunicación.
Yes.
So, so one thing, a little tidbit I'd like to share, and I hope I'm not speaking out of shul. as a lot of listeners know, Drag Race is a reality TV program.
Yeah.
It is unscripted. Mm-hmm. There are no, we do not have writers who we're not fed lines. We don't go into the confessional rooms and read from a script.
Right.
We are asked questions. We're asked to comment, to explain, to elaborate about, our intentions, our motivations, why we did and do what we do in the context of the competition,
right,
in the workroom, in the challenges, what we observe, how we interpret certain behaviors, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm really proud of, the way that I behaved myself on Drag Race, especially on All Stars 2. Because I think that sincere communication is not very easy for many people.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, and especially online, you know, on forms of social media, sincerity is difficult to identify because when someone is using language that is meant to be encouraging and thoughtful and sincere, it's often called out as being disingenuous, mm-hmm. opportunistic, or plain out shamelessly self-promoting, mm-hmm. right? And a good example of this is like when you see a yoga person post like a nearly nude picture of their like sweaty, hot body in a contorted pose. And then the caption reads like, "Change comes from within." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what are you really selling here, honey?
Sure, right. Know? What's the reaction that you want
to? Yeah. Are you just hawking them titties, or are you trying to trade in Vedic philosophy?
Yeah.
And you know, that's all, but that's really just the interpretation. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes down to what is the intention and what is the motivation and what is the desire there. In America, sex sells.
Sure.
So it's often very complicated, but in terms of speaking from the heart, it's often, what I've observed is that it's often, seen as not very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's discouraged.
Right.
And a lot of communication is relayed in an ironic or self-deprecating tone or voice. Yeah. And, the challenge of speaking from the heart on Drag Race these days is that we've seen it all before.
Sure.
You know, we've seen it all before. Now it's like a lot of the behaviors on Drag Race are immediately they're witnessed and simultaneously interpreted in relation to what has come before.
Sure.
You know, so for example, like when the cast images are presented for the first time, when the promo rolls out, it's like, oh, that's the Pearl.
Yeah,
oh, that's the Tatiana. Oh, that's the Tyra.
Right.
Oh, that's the Willem. Like mm-hmm. I remember when the season 7 images rolled out, I was lambasted online for being a Willem ripoff.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Because of the look and because of my kind of
my cheeky nature,
exactly. And my in the promo I appeared to be very ironic, sarcastic, aloof, and kind of like shit disturby.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Of course, I also looked like a slut. And I got to tell you, there's more room in the world for there's plenty of room for white blonde sluts out there. You know, the more the merrier. But when I look back on, on season 7, I had a lot of moments where I felt that I didn't perform to my best, but the one thing that I'm particularly proud of, and that I think speaks to the nature of Drag Race, is the sort of speech that I gave at the finale or the last episode of All Stars 2, where mm-hmm. you kind of plead your case for why you should win.
Yeah,
you know, and I admittedly am not a very I'm not a ruthless competitor. Mm-hmm. That's not my nature.
You're more of a ruthless achiever, right?
I'm a ruthless achiever when it comes to myself.
Right.
You know, I'm my own worst critic and I'm my own worst enema. So in terms of, you know, people want to call out behavior for being fake. Mm-hmm. And I think that fake is way too vague of a term.
Sure.
You know, because we're not able, I think that a lot of viewers are not able to clearly identify what kind of language is reverent, irreverent, sincere, ironic, opportunistic, or straight out exploitative.
Right.
You know, it's like a lot of times people will call out the moments where a person is at the makeup station and they're sharing personal moments from their past. And it's kind of, some people view it as exploitative. Some people view it as opportunistic. Others view it as intentionally manipulative, trying to get the audience on your side.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, well, hey guys, my whole family was mowed down by a giant lawnmower. Can I win the crown? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you know, of course the strings start swelling in the soundtrack.
Yeah.
And then, oh, now we know this is for the time I'm supposed to cry.
Right. Right.
Or whatever. But
whereas, so, you know, you could look at it as a very sincere moment in the show. I always look at it as like, okay, we're getting to know them. We're getting to know everyone's struggle.
Right. And it all happens within a context in a 43 minute reality format.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're not watching high drama. It's not Shakespeare.
And it's also intended to provoke and elicit emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like Rue has said many times, one of the thrusts of the program, one of its mission statements is the tenacity of the human spirit.
Right.
You know, and Drag Race means many things to many people, but my instincts on the show were to be real.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking in the workroom and having extreme anxiety about how my drag character would be perceived and received by the general public outside of a performance context.
Yeah.
You know, but what I was able to do at the end of All Stars 2 was I remember being in the workroom. I didn't write anything down.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, speaking from the heart, it has to be in the moment. It has to be informed by the present moment in terms of who I'm talking to, a clear and honest kind of consideration of what I'm feeling,
mm-hmm.
and what motivates me. And in a sense of honesty, but also lightness. And I remember that I wanted to keep it short and sweet.
Yeah.
And I wanted to keep it real. And I mined emotion in a way that almost made me cry legitimately.
Yeah.
But I plugged it up because I wanted to kind of go deep, but then just keep it light.
Right.
And I'm really, and speaking from the heart means being real. And nowadays, I don't know that that is even really possible.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean that moment of going in there and just
laying it all out.
Yeah.
Laying it all out, because of course it's edited. I don't know. I've always been able to maintain a level of realness, but you know, it's all subject to interpretation.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it's like you can be intentionally manipulating people into trying to love you.
Right.
Or you can just be telling the truth. You know, at the end of the day, you don't really have much control over what is perceived and interpreted. Right. All you have is your gut.
Right.
And I remember, you know, Rue said, bring the realness.
Yeah.
You know, like, so make it count. Say what you really feel, make it honest. And that's what I think I managed to do on most of the show. But I've resisted that in a lot of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I've avoided using my sincere voice only in the service of entertainment, not really intentionally trying to obfuscate my real feelings or intentions, but, I'm a trickster, you know,
uh-huh.
and I'm an entertainer and artist, and I like fucking with people.
Sure. And also, do you think that it has to do with the context?
It does.
Because, you know, you're not at RuPaul's show. You're at an interview where it doesn't mean as much.
No, I'm in drag too, yeah. You know, but I've struggled. You know, I had dinner last night with a friend that I met because of the show.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really cool guy. He's a drummer for the band Rancid, Brandon Steinekert. I met him and his girlfriend, and we became really fast friends in a way that is kind of, I think you talked about is like, or Devin talked about, it's like a common in Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
You can be best friends right at once. But we vibed right away. We had this really like deep and easy and effortless kind of connection.
Sure.
And he was like, And, you know, I remember telling me, he's like, you know, don't ever feel like you have to be on around us.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we like you.
Right.
And that really stuck with me. And, you know, it is difficult to be a public figure or to be admired for your personality or your perceived way of being.
Right.
And with that comes almost like an inability to show your vulnerable side.
Or any other side.
Or any other side other than on high alert, high full tilt and entertainment mode.
Right.
And then you sort of, you lose track of, okay, well, who the hell is the real me?
Yeah.
Because my drag character is a Russian whore with an accent, but I never really did it on the show.
Right.
You know? And, but that was my drag character. It was it's acting.
Yeah.
It's acting.
Right.
It's not, it's a character.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with me. I chose that voice because in order to project an air of world-weary, jaded confidence, mm-hmm. Russian seemed appropriate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But now I'm having to, I'm getting the opportunity to explore the fact that regardless of the accent and without, you know, ditching the character, I can still have an articulate and semi-coherent point of view. Just naturally.
Yeah, exactly.
Without trying to impress anybody.
Like Devin was saying.
Yeah.
You know, just be
just
you.
Be yourself.
Right.
Because that's what we want.
Yeah.
You know, and then the work is, okay, so I've got that. All it's just about choice, restraint, and boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Since sort of like taking a break from drag, I've had the discipline to tune out the noise.
Yeah.
And
define the noise a little
well,
bit.
Well, the noise for me is social media.
Okay.
You know, I lived on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Craig, I fucking lived on social media. I was so active on social media, and I just, whatever, it was always very effortless. I never, ever, I was never felt any anxiety towards it. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I'll just share. Everything that popped into my mind, I just shared. I had my, you know, the phone was almost glued to my hand.
Yeah.
I was, whenever I was walking around exploring cities, I would just Instagram the whole thing and find things that I thought were pretty or interesting or beautiful, share them up, throw up, you know, it was just a never ending stream of free content.
Yeah.
And it was almost as if my life was being surveilled by myself.
Yeah.
I was a willing participant in this surveillance style of life that blurred the boundaries between the professional and the personal in such a way that I had no idea who the fuck I was anymore.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And I was monetizing every minute of my life in the service of some kind of nebulous professional goal that was not even clear to me.
Right.
You know, and it would just became way, way, way too much.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where people would start following me because they'd be like, oh, we saw that you snapped this or we saw that you Instagrammed this. So we just came there. That's just the nature of having fans or whatever.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
You know, they're like, oh, we saw that you were out, so we came out and now we want to be your friend. And I was like, yikes. Oh shit. Okay. I don't really want that.
Yeah.
You know, and it was so strange because
I just want lunch by myself.
I kind of just want to like hang and chill. But it gets into this disingenuous kind of blurred, passive aggressive little dance where you're like, I want to be seen, but don't watch me. You know,
yeah.
I want to put this content up, but you have to pay for it. Or I want everything to be free, but I'm also whatever, you know? And I was like, okay, it's time for a total recalibration of how I choose to be a person, how I choose to approach a professional life, and how I choose to edit
mm-hmm.
all of these features of my life experience in such a way that I can achieve some sense of normalcy after being granted this gift, which also is something of a curse.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, well, you know, you hear this all the time. It's like, well, honey, if you don't want to take a picture with me, why'd you go on reality TV? And I was at Mickey's once, a bar in West Hollywood. I engaged willingly in a 20 minute futile exercise in explaining myself to a drunk person because I had a sunburn and didn't want to take a picture.
Yeah.
It was the usual thing. It was like, well, I thought you were the nice one. Ugh. Like, wait a minute. You know what? I knew it. I knew you weren't as nice as I thought you were on TV.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of wasted breath expressing all these points actually quite coherently to this drunk person who then I'm sure woke up the next day with no recollection of the, you know what I mean? It was like,
right.
It's just an exercise in futility. And it, but on the other hand, it's also funny because it's like, you know, I'm saying, I want to be famous, but don't, but get away. Like, uh-huh. I really want help, but don't touch me. I really want to be included, but get the, you know, but I won't show up. You know, it's such a big learning curve. I think, but what I've discovered is that it's totally okay to say no.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's more than okay to say no, but you know, you have to have the balls to stick to your guns in the moment and say, and to say, no, but thank you.
Right. And whether or not they're going to go into some rant about
some
how you're
rant.
Not. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I've observed when I've looked at the comments, sometimes I'll see that there's a lot of infighting. You know, I'm one of the girls from, or I'm one of the performers from the show that happens to enjoy a pretty large fan base. And I, you know, and it'll, every once in a while it comes to my attention that there's like infighting within the fandom or whatever. Yeah. It's a lot of foolishness, but you know, it's like, no, don't call her Brian or call her Katya or don't, she doesn't like mom or this or that. And then you got like these kids just squabbling over trivial bullshit on Twitter. And it's like, you know, there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
At the end of the day, it's like, you know, I think it's just, you have to realize that you do what you do. A lot of it's falling on deaf ears, and people want out of you what they want out of you, and sometimes you just can't control anything.
Right, and sometimes you can't give them what they want.
Right, you know, and I always go back, you know, like especially with dealing with this stuff, I always try to go back to the wisdom that Rue imparts so freely and generously that, you know, you want a career in Hollywood, how much rejection and humiliation can you stand? You know, and I really, a lot of the thing is that I really don't like rejection,
right?
Which is why I've worked so hard and been so stubborn about creating my own projects.
Yeah.
You know, and I went on an audition once and I remember, it was for a waiter at a restaurant on a hit show. And they were like, I was so terrified. I was nervous as hell.
Yeah.
And, also on drugs, by the way, but, that didn't help. But, you know, he's like, you know, you can go more gay with it. Just real fag out.
Oh.
And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
I just want to leave. And so I just tried it. It felt, I mean, I was there for like 3 seconds and they're like, all right, thank you. Bye.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then the next audition I went on, they were like, I was just me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I got it, you know?
Well, I got it.
Oh shit. Sorry about the feet on the couch.
Oh, that's okay.
So uncouth.
That's okay. I'll just bleach it down.
Yeah. But, you know, and it's just the, you know, putting yourself out there is always, it's always like a double-edged sword because our, you know, as performers, we're so sensitive, we're so narcissistic and we're so stubborn. And then we're, you know, oh God, it, you know, I think everybody struggles with it. It's like, I want to just pour my heart out, but then I don't want to be available to any piece of feedback about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's also a valid thing.
Yeah.
You know, why should you have to take
no, on? I mean, yeah, I don't. And it's, yeah. I think it's the, you know, kind of, recoiling from the mess that I made where I just made myself so available to every piece of criticism and everything. And then I just like, I'm like, you know what? I don't have to make myself so available. I don't have to be oversaturated. I don't have to be so fraught with anxiety about, is my career going to end if I don't do a gig every day?
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, it just, the ability to say no has been tremendous. And you know, I've had to cut some relationships, not in only the way I knew how, which is not very good. Mm-hmm. But it's all learning curve.
It's all learning curve. Most people aren't that skilled at how to end a relationship. It's not something that you get a lesson in.
No,
like a school.
You certainly don't. And it's you know, and for sensitive folks and people who are queer, bisexual, transgender, whatever, we're saddled with a lot more mystery about how to have really, like, you know, my father didn't know how to raise a gay kid.
Sure.
But he did the best damn job he could.
Yeah.
You know, and my parents were extremely skillful in their sensitivity towards my weirdness and my sensitivity and my bizarre nature.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we got to choose our battles.
Right.
And sometimes we just, I think, you know, Maria Bamford has the funniest bit about, she talks about some this horrific scene about somebody leaving their pet in a hot car.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you know, sometimes, you know, they're like, we're all just doing the best we can. And sometimes it's just not very good. But I insist on being open and public about it because I know that from the feedback, I know that it helps people.
Sure.
And maybe it sounds naive or idealistic. I want to help people.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Yeah.
I really do. I've always wanted to, I want to talk to every single person in the goddamn earth.
Well, doing it through a show is a much more efficient way than person by person.
Person to person. Hey, listen, I've done the person to person and it's quite taxing, but it's also
the gas. It's a lot of traveling. Yeah.
The mileage has wreaked havoc on my crow's feet. Yeah. It's really tough. That's why I know going back, I was like, that's why I wanted to learn all these languages.
Right.
You know, I was always wanting to learn. I started with French and then Latin and then a little bit of Spanish and Italian and then Russian and then a little bit German and then Japanese. And then like, I want to be able to go anywhere and talk to anybody.
Yeah.
And it's I'm always so fascinated by the thing that scares me the most. And I love that about myself.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing we were talking about before, right? Where if you're not uneasy a little bit about something, then maybe it's not as valuable.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, like that was that Shakespeare's it's not Shakespeare, the cliche, the unexamined life is not worth living and mm-hmm. you know, anything worth doing is going to be difficult.
Right.
You know? Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway with like fear and anxiety is that you got to realize this disease of this mental dysfunction of being terminally unique is the ultimate ruiner of self-esteem and mental health.
Yeah.
Nobody is unique.
Yeah.
No one. Like right. That is just not, it's just a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's been through it, going through it, or will go through it. Like if you've dreamed of it, there are at least 15,000 people who have written the book about it.
Right. So romanticizing that kind of fear.
Yeah.
It's
a common thing, and it's a real tough cross to bear.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's the ultimate alienator from other people and from yourself. Is like, nobody knows my troubles.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. I think of Daphne Zuniga in Spaceballs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Nobody knows the trouble I feel. A Jewish princess. You know, but everybody knows. Everybody knows.
Yeah.
Read a book, Mary. Yeah. Everybody knows, right. You know. Reading is fundamental, and I'm not talking about the drag queen version of shade throwing.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the actual reading of books. Like, I remember I've never related more to or looked up to a person and related to a such a biting observation and critical perception of reality than I did when I read David Foster Wallace's book, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, when he talks about a cruise ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read a bunch of his books, and then he died.
Right.
And I cried my eyes out.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, the smartest man on earth decided it wasn't worth it. Fuck. It was the grimmest, most morose experience. Like,
yeah.
Just, I was like, oh my God.
But also one could say mentally ill.
Yeah.
So that, you know, definitely affected his decision making.
Yeah. And you know, he suffered from extreme performance anxiety when he would, do like Q&As or read book reads at like talks at like a book tour.
Yeah.
Crippled.
Okay.
With anxiety.
Right.
And I heard a story that he once his like agent or the book promoter, whatever you call it, like forced him to go. He like wanted to leave and they forced him to stay and do it.
Yeah.
And he was just like unraveling at the seams. And it's like the fear of putting yourself out there for public scrutiny and review is a thing that goes back thousands of years. Everybody hates it.
Yeah.
It's really, really tough.
And it comes in waves too.
Yeah.
Even when you have a good handle on it, it can still sneak up and bite you.
Absolutely. Like life is not linear.
No.
It is not linear. And the accumulation of facts and knowledge does not equal a better person necessarily. I think mostly the betterment of yourself and self-improvement is a process of uncovering and uncluttering and unlearning rather than accumulating.
Right.
And it's getting, you know, getting back to it's like basically you want a Benjamin Button.
So that's easy, right? Ladies and gentlemen, just Benjamin Button it.
Just girl, just Benjamin Button yourself. You want to die a baby. There was a restaurant on Comm Ave called Noodle Street. back in Boston, this is a non sequitur and a tangent, very short. I went on Comm Avenue, I went to BU for 1 year, and there was a restaurant called Noodle Street, and I'll never forget, on the menu it said, Grandmom says yes.
That was a menu item, or
no,
that
no,
was
no.
Just
it
a
was
statement.
It was just a statement, in, okay. And I believe in like a word
a
bubble,
font.
A zippy font, yeah, a zippy a cartoonish font, and it was an endorsement of the food.
Sure, Grandmom loves it.
Grandmom,
yeah, she says yes.
Grandmom, you know what she says? Yes.
So when you're struggling with some fear and anxiety, just think, Grandmom says
just
yes.
Take it to Noodle Street. You know, just drive it down to Noodle
Baby,
Street.
Take it to Noodle Street and come in hot.
We're coming in hot.
Down on Noodle Street.
Pull out wet, jam it back in dry.
Yeah.
I don't know, Craig. I don't really have much more to say. One little nugget of wisdom I would like to impart, just for my personal journey, is that I, in addition to hardcore narcotics, I am currently detoxifying from an overuse of the internet the information superhighway, the internet.
Yes, as it's sometimes known.
Yeah, as it is known. And I have to tell you, the clarification of my mind stuffs is formidable and fabulous.
You can feel the difference.
You can taste the difference. It's the true Pepsi challenge of the mind. And like I just mentioned that David Foster Wallace did also talk about in a speech he delivered at a university commencement ceremony, the choice of what to fill your consciousness with is the critical one.
That's true.
It's how you, what you choose to consume in terms of information.
Yeah.
You know, and also your friends too is like, I'll never forget my man Vinny in rehab said, show me a man's friends and I'll tell you who he is.
Oh, that's true.
You know?
Well, you can judge a person by the company they keep.
Exactly. And, you know, hey, bub, why don't you look around? If you're surrounded with scumbag, bullshit, shit can motherfuckers, there's a good old chance you're one of them.
That's true. So take a good look around and start cutting them down.
Take a look at yourself. Yeah. Wield that machete with impunity.
Mm-hmm.
And strike down ye. No, you know, it just
not really.
No,
kids.
Don't
that's,
do that.
Of course,
do that. Yeah. Keep the machetes in the glove box.
That's right.
Yeah,
where they're, you know, useful for any kind of roadside troubles.
Roadside troubles and jungle explorations,
Which is the theme of next week's episode.
Stay tuned, but we will interview many jungle doctors.
Jungle doctors who had to deal with some roadside troubles. How did they diagnose? How did they treat it? And what were the results at the end?
And here's a hint. It has a lot to do with turmeric. Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm done. Are you done?
Yeah, I think I'm done.
All right. Well, hey, well, happy trails to you, and we'll see them all next time.
Yeah, see you next time. Same to you, babe.
Bye.
Good night. It's whimsically volatile.